Greetings, this is Bob Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope Magazine. I am on the phone with Dr. Kevin Shewinsky, a distinguished astronomer at Yale University. Kevin is a specialist in galaxy evolution, and he is the co-founder of Galaxy Zoo. He authored the cover story about this groundbreaking project in the November 2011 issue of Sky and Telescope magazine, our 70th anniversary issue. Kevin, thanks for joining us today, and congratulations for the tremendous success of Galaxy Zoo.
Glad to be here.
You mentioned this in your article, that Galaxy Zoo and Galaxy Zoo 2 are officially over after very successful runs, but can citizen scientists who are interested still go to a website and classify galaxies?
Oh, definitely. We still need your help. There's more data that needs to be sorted and analyzed, and lots more discoveries, I think, are still waiting to be made. What we've done is we've moved on to data from the Hubble Space Telescope, and so what you see right now are images taken by Hubble of some of the deepest fields, and in the near future we'll start putting in infrared images taken by the new camera on board Hubble that was installed by the astronauts just about 2 years ago.
Oh, wonderful. And do you know how many different individual people participated in Galaxy Zoo and Galaxy 2 in terms of number of unique people who classified galaxies?
In the Galaxy Zoo project, it's somewhere on the order of 250,000 or more. And across the whole Zooniverse, which is sort of our collection of citizen science projects that have been the follow-on or inspired by the original Galaxy Zoo, we're now over 450,000 unique users.
That's amazing. That's the population of a fairly decent-sized city.
Well, we passed the population of Iceland quite a while back.
Right, right. And you're approaching the population of Boston.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the article that you didn't have such high expectations for the number of participants. Why do you think it is that the level of participation, and fortunately, you know, turned out to be so much higher than what you were expecting?
Well, when we started, we really had no idea who would be interested in doing this, you know, sorting through images of galaxies, because to us it just sounded like, you know, something that would have very limited appeal, and of course, fortunately, we were completely wrong about that. We've teamed up with a number of sociologists to try and study and understand this so that future citizen science projects can be designed and managed better. And so we've sent out questionnaires and asked people, you know, why do you join the Galaxy Zoo? What's your motivation? And we talked to people on our forums and our social networks and asked them, you know, why do you do this? And the number one answer that comes back every time is people want to do something that is actually useful, that's actually contributing to research. They don't just want to consume the science news at the end. They want to actually help out, maybe discover something new, and donate their time, donate their brain to something that's useful.
And you mentioned, too, in the article that the initial hit rate was so high that the computer that was hosting Galaxy Zoo essentially crashed. Did you do a lot of advanced publicity that you think helped get things off the ground so quickly?
For the original launch of Galaxy Zoo, we didn't actually do all that much publicity. We put out a press release, which is sort of what you do. But from then on, we really had very little control over what would happen. And what did happen is that the story went viral, and suddenly your URL goes around the world, and then suddenly your server is no longer able to handle all the interest. In this case, actually, it's not just that the server crashed, it's a cable physically melted because the computer overheated.
That's probably one of the few times in history where maybe scientists were glad that a computer overheated.
Absolutely. Of course, now it was also extremely scary because
yeah.
It meant that the GalaxyZoo.org was no longer reachable, and so all these people going, I'd like to try this out, couldn't. And so we're enormously thankful for our colleagues at Johns Hopkins University, which managed to bring another server back up within a few hours. And we really learned our lesson from this, which is that you have to be prepared for success, you have to be prepared for people wanting to use your website. And the way we do this now is rather than run our own services, we just go to the cloud and we rent services as we need them.
Great. And you wrote in the article that you and astronomer Chris Lintott came up with this idea for Galaxy Zoo in a pub in Oxford, England. And we actually run a photo of the pub in the magazine. Do you remember exactly how this idea came up? Was it something that was kind of percolating, or did it just kind of pop up as you two were talking?
Well, it was based on something I was doing for my own PhD work, which is I was classifying galaxies by eye after I decided that that was pretty much the best way to do it for what I wanted to do, which was find these peculiar type of galaxies called a blue ellipticals. And, you know, none of the computer algorithms that people had used in the past were really doing the job that I wanted it to do, and so there was no choice but to go back and classify the images myself. The problem was there were rather a lot of images, and after about 50,000 or so, I said, you know, thanks, but I don't think I can do the remaining, you know, 950,000. There has to be a better way to do this. And so Chris Lintott and I were sitting in the pub, you know, throwing around ideas of how to, you know, maybe get a few more people involved and see how we could make this task easier. And then we sort of hit on the idea that the place to turn to, of course, is the Internet. And we were inspired by the success of this project called Stardust at Home. Now, Stardust was a spacecraft which sort of traveled through the solar system and passed a comet to try and collect some dust grains, both from the comet and perhaps from the very early solar system. And it brought back these things called aerogel. And they managed to enlist, you know, tens of thousands of people to go look for dust grains suspended in gel. And we thought, well, we have pretty images of galaxies. If people are willing to look for dust grains, maybe they'd also be interested in looking at pretty pictures of galaxies.
And in terms of these classifications that the citizen scientists have done, enormous numbers of them, how do their classifications compare to those made by professional astronomers when they kind of look at the same images? Do they, you know, do the two groups of people make similar classifications, or do you see a difference that the trained eye of a professional might slant things a little bit differently?
Well, this was one of our biggest worries, would the classifications we get back from people who, you know, read a 10-minute tutorial, would they be any good? And it turns out they were spectacularly good. In retrospect, this shouldn't have surprised us, because basically what we ask people to do when they classify galaxies is the pattern recognition task. It's something that the human brain excels at. And so there's really no difference between somebody who spent their career studying galaxy evolution and somebody who joined galaxyzoo.org 15 minutes ago. In fact, it's a bit of a handicap if you're a professional astronomer, because you get hung up on little details and sort of your own little prejudices, whereas somebody who just got started will just you know, go with the flow, and in fact, in many cases, their classifications may even be better.
And that kind of brings me to the next question, and that is, you and your colleagues then are submitting papers to academic journals, you know, where a lot of your data is based on these clicks and decisions made by citizen scientists. Did that make the, you know, editors and referees of these journals nervous about using this kind of data in a, you know, in a prestigious scholarly journal?
When we started getting the first round of Galaxy Zoo papers together, we very quickly decided that the citizen scientists are our collaborators, and so they should be treated as such. And so we actually emailed one of the journals and asked, you know, how would you feel about a paper submission with about 100,000 or so co-authors? And the answer was, you know, not very good, thank you. And so we came up with a different way of recognizing the contributions of the citizen scientists, which is that we make sure that every paper has a link to a web page where everybody who's contributed to Galaxy Zoo, their name is listed. But there's not just a simple list. It's one of these artistic images where we've taken an image of a galaxy, but the galaxy is made up out of everybody's name who contributed. In terms of convincing people that the classifications were good, all we really had to do is show example images of galaxies where, you know, people had reached a certain consensus. And self-evident when people looked at those images that the citizen scientists were doing an absolutely fantastic job.
Right. And then you mentioned, too, that you now have this Hubble Zoo, which seems like a very natural follow-up program to Galaxy Zoo and Galaxy Zoo 2. Is that a case where you're looking at these really faint, high redshift, distant galaxies and trying to see how they might fit into the sequence of galaxies that we see in the local universe?
that's exactly what we're trying to do. Now, because Hubble has so much better spatial resolution and it can see things that are so much fainter, that in many cases the data quality that we get of a distant galaxy with Hubble is roughly similar to what we get with a ground-based telescope of a nearby galaxy. The difficulty with Hubble Zoo really comes in from the fact that as we look further back and further back in cosmic time, galaxies sort of no longer separate nicely into these two types, the elliptical galaxies on the one hand and the spiral galaxies on the other hand, and all sorts of new and funky and embryonic shapes start appearing. And classifying those, making sense of those, turns out to be a little bit more complicated. But the citizen scientists are doing a fantastic job.
And do you have any idea or estimate of when we might start seeing published papers and results from Hubble Zoo?
I suspect those will still be at least a couple of months away.
Maybe try to shift yourself forward 10 or 20 years from now into the future. What do you think people are going to think when they look back on Galaxy Zoo?
Well, I hope that people will think that we've made some contribution to understanding galaxy evolution and formation, but even more so that we've really brought the citizen science approach to the masses, that we figured out a way of doing it, which is then easy to implement by other people. So at the zooniverse.org, we're trying to make it easy for scientists, not just astronomers, to go start up their own citizen science problem. There are a lot of problems in astronomy and in science beyond where people have large amounts of data, and this will get worse and worse as we go into the future, as our collection devices, whether they be telescopes or microscopes, will become more and more powerful. And in order to sort through these, we will need the help of human eyes and human brains. And so looking back, I really hope that Galaxy Zoo will have inspired people to go turn to help from the public.
Just getting into a few of the specific scientific results, one thing that you wrote about in your article that I found very interesting is that we see these blue ellipticals that are, elliptical galaxies, but with a lot of young stars that are quite different from the larger, redder ellipticals that we see nearby, for example, M87 in the Virgo cluster. Do you think that these blue ellipticals are somehow related to the older ones and they'll eventually evolve into these larger red ellipticals, or do you think maybe we're seeing something, some new phase in galaxy evolution?
I think it'll be something along those lines. We know that the old red and dead ellipticals like M87 formed all of their stars in a very intense burst of star formation in the early universe that was then rapidly quenched, and they've basically more or less existed in the way they are forever after until we see them today, perhaps accreting the odd galaxy here or there and incorporating it. As we go down in the mass scale of ellipticals, the stellar ages become younger and younger until we get to the point where we're looking today at the lowest mass range of elliptical galaxies. We're starting to see not just the ones that have recently shut down their star formation, we also see the really blue ones, the ones that are still in the process of formation. And so if it is indeed the case that these smaller ellipticals are just the smaller late-coming cousins of the big ones like M87, then maybe those blue ellipticals can give us some insights into the physics, the formation process of elliptical galaxies.
Right. And your article also talked about these green peas galaxies, which seem really bizarre. What do you think's going on with those?
Yeah, the green peas were a fascinating discovery because nobody was looking for them. And what happened is the citizen scientists noticed these images of galaxies that were small, round, and greenish in the color composite image that we gave to people. And they started collecting them, and they called them peas. And when I moved to the U.S., I linked up with a graduate student, Carrie Cardamon, and said, you should try and figure out what these things are. And so she went and analyzed them, and what we learned was really fascinating. These green pea galaxies are very intense, very compact starbursting galaxies, and they seem to be in pretty much isolated regions of the universe. And they don't seem to be enriched by the sort of heavy elements that get produced by lots of star formation. So they look really out of place in the local universe, and what they really look like are the primordial galaxies in the early universe, so just coming together, having the first intense burst of star formation. they're kind of like living fossils, and the citizen scientists found them in the zoo.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that these things would be existing in the modern-day universe because, you know, we clearly see that over cosmic history that star formation in general is kind of winding down. And you don't get the sense that there's, like, you know, really significant-sized galaxies kind of forming anymore, that they formed long ago. And you mentioned these are kind of, these green peas are kind of out in the field. I mean, are they in these voids or just not in clusters? Like, where exactly are they being found?
It's really hard to tell. That they're sufficiently far away from us that quantifying exactly what kind of environments they live in actually becomes very difficult. But as far as we can tell, they are in these low-density regions of space where, you know, if you had anything sort of hanging on that hasn't had a chance yet to collapse or merge, that's where you'd be looking.
Yeah, and you mentioned, too, with Galaxy Zoo 2, this whole issue about, you know, bars forming in spiral galaxies and relationships of galaxies with their supermassive black holes. In terms of extending this to Galaxy Zoo 2, what would you say has been some of the most important results from that?
Like the blue ellipticals, what we found with Galaxy Zoo were these red spirals. They look like spiral galaxies. They still have their beautiful spiral structure, but they don't exhibit any sort of blue light being given off by star formation. And we're trying to figure out exactly what's going on there. There's sort of two hypotheses. They either have a lot of dust, so the star formation is hidden away, or they simply shut down their star formation and over a long period of time gently dying down, perhaps as they enter more dense environments, giving rise to their red colors.
When you started Galaxy Zoo, I mean, did you have any idea that you'd be finding, you know, these red ellipticals and green peas and blue ellipticals? It seemed that, like, you wouldn't have expected you would have had this much of a harvest from these citizen scientists.
It was really wonderful, and I think it shows why it's so useful to have human eyes and human brains going through your data.
Right. This is really quite an amazing story, and I want to really thank you also for writing the article for Sky and Telescope.
Well, I'm really, you know, absolutely flattered by your interest, and I think it's such a great opportunity to show what we've done and what we'll be able to do in the future. And, you know, I hope we'll keep supplying you with interesting astronomy/citizen science stories in the future.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I really appreciate all of your time and help, and I want to wish you the best with Hubble Zoo as well.
Thank you very much.